Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new report from the American Heart Association reveals that almost half of adults in the U.S. have heart disease, and high blood pressure is a big factor. A doctor walks us through what we need to know. First, it's Food Friday, and this week we're exploring the cuisines of South America. Empanadas are a familiar sight, but there's a lot more out there to enjoy, from hearty stews to fresh fish and desserts. Our next guest has been trying her hand at some of these in the last month, and she's with us in the studio right now. Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and a Food Friday regular. She'll also be leading a WPR travel vacation to Chile and Argentina this October. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here, although I got overwhelmed in the last 2 months.
Well, yes, because we are talking about a whole continent with many different influences and a variety of cuisines. I have to say, having been to Bolivia, even from very high altitudes to lower, to middle to lower, mm-hmm. totally different foods and ingredients. So there's a lot going on here, but are there some ingredients that, as you were doing research, that you see being kind of a common thread in these cuisines?
A lot of what we think of as New World foods, and that's what ended up making certain dishes that you could tell came from, say, Spain or Italy, not feel like something from Spain or Italy.
So what are some of those New World influences?
You'll find a lot of corn. Obviously, and we talk about the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash of some kind. That will show up added to a number of dishes that you may not expect right away. There are a number of sweet potatoes, different kinds of yams, some native and some that were brought in, certainly with African people coming and being in those cultures as well. We don't think of South America as having plains that are devoted to agriculture. We either think of the coast with all of that great seafood, or especially with Argentina, we think gauchos, we think beef, we think a lot of ranching.
Well, I just want to say people that are not from there, stuck
in the Midwest, I should say, that don't tend to think about, because we do hear a lot about the beef, that those great barbecues where every part of the animal is on that grill. We don't tend to think about all of the fields of wheat and corn. We don't think about growing a lot of quinoa, which is an amaranth plant, but that's an annual, has to be planted every year. We don't think about certain starchy vegetables that we don't have, or we would really have to work hard to get, like yucca and plantains. And so a lot of the ingredients might be a little bit difficult to come across, but if you do a little bit of digging, one of the things that shows up a lot is that a lot of these ingredients freeze very well. So if you've got a Latin American grocery anywhere in your neighborhood, check out the freezer section and you just might be able to find what it is you're looking for.
And I have to say, actually, you're talking about being able to get some ingredients frozen. I have a favorite quinoa kind of bake that freezes beautifully. So it can freeze maybe on both ends of the spectrum.
Absolutely.
So not uncommon in any cuisine is a starchy or a grain ingredient that gets paired with some kind of a sauce to add flavor. What kind of condiments are popular with South American cooks?
Oh, brother. All right. You say, again, coming back to our relatively limited Midwestern palate, at least limited for some of us. You say salsa, and we think, well, that's what you dip your chips in. There are a number of sauces, salsas, and a lot of them are just on the table at all times. Rather than make a dish with a specific heat level, a dish is made, again, with something that could be relatively bland, but it's livened up by what you choose to put on it at the table. A lot of the salsas that we think of, chopped vegetables, are often served with just a little bit of acid. But then you start blending other things in, like pebre and chimichurri are types of sauces that have a lot of hot pepper or sometimes a lot of ground pepper, and those are blended more with oils than with acids. If you go to any of the Andean regions, go up further into the mountains, they're going to use things that are very unexpected for the Midwest, creamy sauces. They are nut-based, they are seed-based, or in some cases, cheese-based. Mayonnaise is popular for certain things, especially if you do have a hot dish and want to cool the heat a little bit. There is a great love of the garlic aioli, which I normally think of as French, but that is a mayonnaise dish, that a mayonnaise sauce that's used a lot. But it's also a good base for hot peppers. It's a good base for herbs. One thing I haven't made yet, but I'm dying to try, is what Venezuelans use avocados for. They call it, I believe, guasacaca. It's basically guacamole with a lot of peppers added, and you puree it. You actually run it through the blender in most cases.
It has a uniformly smooth
really consistency. Creamy, really wonderful. I've had it served to me, but I've never made it myself. There's mojo. This is a sauce with a lot of garlic and vinegar or citrus juice, and mojo means to moisten. So that's not there just to add flavor, but it's also there to change the texture, especially if your barbecue got a little bit too dry. And then, of course, there's all the different soured creams and soured milks that show up, and that is considered a sauce as well. Obviously, in a climate this warm, dairy is going to curdle. So you see a lot of canned milk that's used, or you will let it lightly ferment. You can use sour cream if you're starting off, but it's not quite the same taste. Sour cream, for want of a better word, is a little bit bland against some of what you're doing with South America, whereas a crema, again, if you have a Latin American grocery in your neighborhood, check this out, because getting actual crema from South America, the taste is brighter and pairs much better with the ingredients we're working with. It's actually one of those things that if you've got time and are feeling like I need another do-it-yourself project, making various soured milks and cremas is something you can do in your own kitchen. That's a great thing to set your search engine up for. So if you're feeling ambitious or you want to get somebody involved in another project, that may be one to try.
We're talking right now with Lori Skelton on Food Friday. She's a WPR classical music host. She joins us every few months on Food Friday. And we're looking at some of the cuisines of South America this time around. Lori will be leading a WPR travel vacation to Chile and Argentina this October. And you mentioned this a little in passing, Lori, but I wanted to go back to it. Is there a range in how spicy some of these South American dishes are?
Absolutely. If you're worried about, I don't want to dive into this because I've had something that was Mexican and it blew my ears off, South American food runs the gamut, in part because there is such an influence of Europe to be found in South American cooking. To my surprise, between 1860 and 1900, over half of the immigrants to Argentina, for instance, were from Italy. And so you will find pasta. You will find ravioli in Argentina. You will find gnocchi in Argentina. Their version of grilled cheese is to grill provolone and then throw on herbs and maybe some chili flakes and let it get crispy on the outside, gooey on the inside, and eat it that way. So you don't have to worry about heat level. Again, that's what having all those different condiments on the table. And yes, some of them are going to be incredibly hot and spicy, but you play with it as you see fit. Start off with a lovely plate of, say, baked beans, or refried beans, excuse me, and you'll add to that as however hot you want it.
One of the maybe most commonly known South American dishes outside of South America are empanadas. And you found a lot of variations to them. First of all, let's start from the very beginning. What are the basics of what makes an empanada an empanada?
Ever had a pasty?
Yes.
It's, think about it as a pasty, although the variety of fillings is much more diverse in South America. Some of them are small and half moon shaped. Some of them, especially in Chile, will get almost the size of a pizza.
Wow.
They can be squared off.
So like a calzone.
Are squared off rather than that half moon shape. You're going to find some of them that are baked, some of them that are fried. You can get wrappers, again, in the freezer. The Goya brand is a really easy one to find. They have two of them, one that produces a flaky, like a puff pastry, and one that produces a pastry that's a little bit closer to a standard pie crust. I'm told that the flaky pastry one is better for a baked empanada, and the other one is better for fried. Frankly, I think this would be a perfect case of pick your favorite and do with it what you want. If you're going to make your own pastry, this is where it can really get interesting. The pastries can be very, very complex. Mary Berry would have a great time with it.
Great British baking show judge.
You can make it from wheat flour, corn flour, yucca flour, plantain flour. A lot of empanada, though, calls for lard. I did find a number of recipes where olive oil is used. You can enrich your empanada dough with sugar, powdered milk, eggs, butter, even wine. And your fillings can vary. Obviously, if you're on the coast, mariscos, any kind of seafood would be fantastic. But there is very often, especially in Chile, a way to make a kind of a sweet and sour component. A really popular blend of ingredients is known as pino, and this is going to have minced meat, onions, raisins, black olives, and chunked up hard-boiled eggs. So that's just a start on empanadas. But basically, anything you can think to fill in your savory pastry, I've discovered it's a really great way. We were talking in December about how to use up leftovers in the kitchen. It's a really great way to use up leftover roasted vegetables.
Oh,
wrap them
great.
Up in pastry, and drizzle a little crema on top, and you're good to go.
Sounds delicious. Lori Skelton is with us on Food Friday, and we're talking about some of the cuisines of South America. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are there South American dishes you like to make at home? If you're from South America or if you visited there, what foods do you really love? Do you have tips for us on making empanadas, carbonara, or some other dish? What questions do you have for Lori about her experiments with South American cuisine? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our chat with Lori Skelton about South American cooking, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you like to make South American dishes in your kitchen? What are some of your favorite South American ingredients, flavorings, or dishes? If you have advice for us on a favorite recipe, let us know. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Before we move further, Lori, we were talking about empanadas and we were talking about savory ones, but you did mention that sugar was a possible addition into the dough. So I'm guessing there might be sweet fillings too.
Believe it or not, when I mentioned sugar, that was for a savory recipe.
Really? Interesting.
A lot of times you will find sugar in just a little bit in South American dishes. I think it's there, one, to increase the caramelization, whether you're actually dressing your meat before you sear it with a little bit of sugar, or you've got it in the pastry to, again, add that little extra crispy sweet. But again, there is a lot of love in South America, I'm finding, where there's just a hint of sweet to play against other savory flavors. I guess they think of it the way we would think of salt, as you put just a little extra on and it brings up the flavor rather than taste salty. Here, the sugar is bringing out the flavor rather than tasting sweet.
Interesting.
Which is not to say that you can't have lovely fried sweet things. Sopapillas, fried pumpkin fritters with a, dusted with a little sugar. Great street food.
Well, and our board operator today, Sarah, said that she loves the guava ones from the Caracas Empanada Cart on Library Mall here in Madison.
Yes.
So they do exist. And now I want one. Thanks a lot, Sarah. Well, something that's closely tied to Argentina, but actually shows up all over South America, is carbonada. And there are a lot of different types. But at its core, what is carbonada?
Okay. If you're going to have a very basic kind of soup or stew, that's usually going to be called a cazuela. And you're going to be thinking, okay, basic meat, some vegetables, a good flavorful broth, but nothing terribly fancy. Carbonada is where you're going to find more time, more effort. Cookbooks will refer to what the meat and the vegetables are cooked in, not as a broth, but as a sauce. This is going to be something heartier. Probably it's going to have a great deal of, say, Spanish paprika, tomatoes, wine. This is a stew that is done in stages rather than sear your meat, throw everything in the pot, and then eat it when everything's falling apart. Carbonada will take you a little bit of time, but boy, is it worth it. I've fallen in love with the Argentinian version, where you've got meat, where you've got your tomatoes, your bell peppers, you've got your squash, you've got your corn, and then you've got dried fruit. Beef with apricots and raisins is really, really popular. The recipe that I handed in to put on the website has dried peaches in it.
Oh, wow.
And I just love this. This has been one of the best things for this winter. Having, again, that paprika, and there's rosemary and thyme in it. It's a very full-flavored sauce. But having the peaches in it lifts the stew up a little. It doesn't feel like you're eating heavy, stodgy food, even though it's a stew. It's going to make you feel really, really happy on a really cold day.
Well, and you mentioned the recipe that you shared, and people can find the recipe for that up at WPR.org/Food Friday. And Barb in Milwaukee called and was wondering where you got her recipes, if there are any cookbooks you'd recommend. And Lori, I know you came in here with something that looked like the size of a phone book. So.
All right. I admit, I have one of the best in my corner. Maricel Prestia, excuse me, 5 years ago put out a book, The Food of Latin America, Gran Cocina Latina, and this won the James Beard Award Book of the Year in 2013. Not only is she a chef, not only is she a food writer, she has a doctorate in medieval history. So she was able to go back to Europe and pull out 100-year-old texts talking about food and cooking, and was able to trace how certain techniques and certain ingredients made their way into South American cooking today. Now, I'm not saying Gran Cocina Latina has to be on your bookshelf. It's 800 pages. I'm going to be spending the rest of the year with it, getting ready for this trip in October. If it's available in your library, I highly recommend checking it out, even if you don't cook any of the recipes. What she has to say about the history, about the culture, about the general mindset of cooking in South America is absolute poetry. I'm probably going to be taking some of these pages along with me to read on the tour as we're going to check out different places to eat.
Sounds great. Let's go to the phones, and Maria in Madison is up. Hi, Maria.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, I'm good. I've been listening to the program, and I was born in Barranquilla, Colombia, and when I visited there, I've been living in the States since. When I visited there in 68, I went to Cartagena and went to some relatives' house, and they were all around the stove busy cooking sancocho. Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard the term. I thought sancocho was the pot that you cook in. What is it?
Well, what I thought it was a soup. And it had seafood and chicken and corn, cobs, and yucca. Or Well, we call it yuca, either ñame or yuca, one of those roots.
Okay.
Just delicious.
It sounds amazing. Again, that wonderful layered flavoring that you're going to find.
Great. Well, thank you, Maria. And that sounds like one to put on your list.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to the phones, and Ken in La Crosse is up. Hi, Ken.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you like to cook?
Well, the empanadas that you guys were talking about.
Yeah.
What we like to do is we like to put a spicy pork in them. And then with the also with the spicy pork filling, you can make a masa with bananas. And but they have to be a green banana. You spread them out on foil. You can put the spicy pork on that. Roll it up, seal it with the foil, boil it for about an hour, and those are called pasteles, and those are also very good.
Wow, you had me at spicy pork, and then it just got even better from there.
No kidding. What spices were you using in that pork?
You can use whatever, you know, paprika, garlic.
But this needs to be assertive.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just, you know, to make it to your liking.
Okay, and green bananas
instead
of plantains.
That sounds great. Well, thanks for that call, Ken. Boy, my mouth is watering here, Lori. Any final advice or encouragement for those of us that might not have ventured into this style of cooking yet?
Okay, if you're going to get started with anything, I would say go ahead and play with ceviche. If you can get some decent seafood in your area, go ahead and play with, rather than cooking it to death, just use a little bit of some kind of acid. Maybe it's vinegar, maybe it's citrus juice.
Often lime juice, I think, right?
Maybe it's pisco. Maybe it's that great Chilean brandy. And if you're a fan of sushi, if you know you like raw fish, go ahead and cook it a little bit, and you'll play with some onions, some peppers, and that lovely acid. Maybe 5-10 minutes might be all you need to, it'll definitely give you, again, that lift in these last cold days. Ceviche is a wonderful way to feel like you're right on the coast in South America.
Well, Lori, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for giving me this challenge. I intend to keep going.
All right, we'll check in. Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and a regular on Food Friday. She was with us to talk about South American cooking. And you can find the recipe for carbonara criolla that we talked about at WPR.org/Food Friday. New statistics show that nearly half of all American adults are living with some kind of cardiovascular disease. According to the American Heart Association, the increase is due to a lower threshold for what constitutes high blood pressure or hypertension. That condition can lead to a variety of health problems like heart attacks, heart failure, and strokes. Dr. Ivor Benjamin is the director of the Cardiovascular Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he's also the volunteer president of the American Heart Association. Dr. Benjamin, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
My understanding is that recently the guidelines for defining high blood pressure were revised. What was changed?
Well, I think first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to speak about an extremely important topic for all of our communities. Many of us are familiar with previous blood pressure guidelines of 140 over 90 as being hypertensive, or at least that number would be one in which your provider may take interventions. But based on recent science and recent evidence, the American Heart Association has revised the guidelines for treating hypertension or high blood pressure based on a blood pressure of 130 over 80. What this therefore means is that at that blood pressure, you and your provider will be having conversations around diet and exercise, but we know that above that blood pressure, interventions, including medications, will reduce one's risks for heart attacks, strokes, and heart failure. So that's the reason for this revision.
So it seems that many of our listeners may be in the situation where they've been going to their doctor for many years, not hearing that they have high blood pressure, and now their doctor is saying, well, you now qualify as having high blood pressure. How serious is this for people who might now fall into the category of having hypertension?
Fortunately, we know that there are many approaches that are available for treating high blood pressure. So the first item is to be aware. If your blood pressure, after multiple readings, on average, is above 130 over 80, and, by the way, you're doing all the appropriate things, no added salt to the diet, regular exercise, maybe 30 minutes of brisk walking per day. What I tell my patients is that I'm looking for progress, not perfection. So if you do that six times, you know, in a particular week, you're well over the 150 minutes of active exercise. Some people might not be able to exercise. They will actually have other ways. But the point here is that when your blood pressure is above 130 over 80, it says take action. Take action to prevent a heart attack. Take action to prevent a stroke. Take action, of course, to prevent heart failure. And I think working with your provider and equipped with knowledge, one is able to do many things, and this is quite prevalent. And so as I pointed out to you, based on these new guidelines, the American Heart Association can say that from the point of view of cardiovascular disease, 48% of adult Americans have some kind of cardiovascular disease, and the predominant contributor to that is high blood pressure or hypertension.
And can you briefly tell us, how does having higher blood pressure than is healthy directly affect our heart and how well our heart works?
Well, so first and foremost, the heart is a muscle pump, and it's attempting to pump your cardiac output to all regions of the body. When the heart is now working against a higher pressure, it means that it's increasing the demand that's being placed on that muscle pump. It responds a number of ways. It might be able to compensate. So, for example, if you were able to walk up a flight of stairs, you would like your heart rate to increase, and you would like the amount of blood that's being pumped. You would like that to happen. That's a good thing. But imagine now if your heart, even when you're resting, has this much higher pressure. It means that the demands on the heart really are exceeding the potential supplies. That might contribute to clogging of the arteries, and it might also even contribute to where the muscle itself begins to fail. Now, we use this term heart failure. It's a little bit of an awkward, you know, we're not telling people that they're a failure. It just simply means that there is an inability of the heart to meet the peripheral demands of the body. And that's why we call that condition heart failure. And of course, again, if something is not right, it's best to always speak with your provider. It might be a nurse practitioner, it might be a doctor, but oftentimes, you know, just family members are looking around and they're able to see that, you know, Uncle Tom isn't quite right. Let's get this checked out.
Dr. Ivor Benjamin is the director of the Cardiovascular Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also volunteer president of the American Heart Association. And we're talking about the fact that nearly 50% of U.S. adults are now considered to have some form of heart disease. Now, Dr. Benjamin, I can imagine especially people who before did not fall into that high blood pressure category and now do because of the revised guidelines, they might say, you know, I feel fine. I don't think I have this. What should we know about being able to tell, if we can, that we might be at risk of heart disease?
Excellent question. You know, one of the real challenges that we have is to increase our awareness. Hypertension is also sometimes called the silent killer. One of the things that happens, for example, is that high blood pressure can increase one's susceptibility or the chances of having a stroke. And there's a condition that's called atrial fibrillation. You know, sometimes you might be on T TV, and you hear it's sometimes referred to as AFib. Well, one of the biggest risk factors for AFib, well, there are two of them. One is age, and the other is hypertension. Oftentimes, the very first time that people are aware that they actually have AFib is when they have a stroke. We really would like to increase awareness of one blood pressure. And here is really the kicker. It's really so simple to measure your blood pressure. There are these automated blood pressure cuffs that you can actually have. Now, I'm not here trying to promote that this is something, but, you know, if you go down to the Walgreens and while you're waiting perhaps for your prescription to be filled or wherever, take your blood pressure. Know what that is. So I like to tell my patients the same way that you know your age, you need to know what your cholesterol is, you need to know what your blood pressure is. And equipped with knowledge and equipped with that awareness, then you can do something about modifying diet, increasing one's exercise, as well as, of course, being quite adherent with taking medications. So awareness is the key.
And Dr. Benjamin, before we let you go, I'm sure it can be kind of overwhelming to people if they find out that this is something they're at risk for. They might not know where to start. You said that you tell your patients it's about progress, not perfection. What would be the best first step that someone could take to increase their heart health?
I would say the first thing that you should do is to speak with a family member. Because oftentimes, just to take a medication, you know, there's so many stresses in people's lives, they may forget. But if you have an otherwise loving family member who is concerned about your health, this is not something to be ashamed of. This is something that you can do in collaboration with others. Because oftentimes, you know, blood pressure can actually run in families. So it's a good way of increasing, if you will, the health literacy of that family. And so one of the things that we would love to be able to do is to have a family member who can basically measure blood pressure. But as I mentioned, you can actually have one of these automated blood pressure cuffs. And here's something else that I also suggest to my patients. Keep a diary. You should be able to just measure your heart rate and keep your blood pressure, because oftentimes that blood pressure is much more informative when you sit with your provider in the office. There's something that we call the white coat syndrome. And what that means is that you're going to see the doctor and all of a sudden you're a little bit anxious and so forth. And while you're in the doctor's office, your blood pressure is off the charts. But if you're able to keep a diary and you know what your blood pressure is, wow. That's much, much more reassuring, because that says that's what your blood pressure represents in your normal daily activities. Does that help?
It does. Thank you so much for spending time with us, Dr. Benjamin, and for sharing the information.
You're quite welcome. Have a wonderful day.
Dr. Ivor Benjamin is the director of the Cardiovascular Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin and also the volunteer president of the American Heart Association. He joined us to discuss an American Heart Association report that says almost half of all U.S. adults have some type of cardiovascular disease and the role that high blood pressure plays. President Trump signed a spending bill this afternoon that prevents another shutdown and funds the government through the end of September. The bill includes slightly more than $1.3 billion to fund the construction of a 55-mile barrier along the U.S.-Mexico border and more money for the Department of Homeland Security. However, while the president signed off on the bill today, he also announced he's declaring a national emergency in order to secure the rest of the funds for a border wall. Congressional Democrats have already announced they'll push back on the declaration, and some members of President Trump's own party have expressed concern about the move. Our next guest is here to break down the emergency declaration and the potential legal challenges. Jennifer Daskal is an associate professor at the Washington College of Law at American University. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
First, President Trump has been floating the idea of declaring a national emergency for the past several weeks. Here we are now with one having been declared. What are your initial thoughts?
Well, it's a pretty extraordinary use of the National Emergency Act powers. Here we have a situation where the president went to Congress and asked for funding for a wall. Congress deliberated, said no in a very public and vocal way. And the president nonetheless goes ahead and asserts a national emergency and therefore triggers certain authorities that allow him to unilaterally do exactly what Congress said they didn't want him to do.
And what laws dictate what can be considered a national emergency?
So he's operating under the National Emergency Act of 1976, which basically authorizes a president to declare a national emergency, and then it triggers the application of a wide range of potential statutes. There's hundreds of statutes in the U.S. Code that can be triggered pursuant to a declaration of national emergency. This was done, the act was enacted in part as a means of reining in executive power after the Watergate scandal. But there's never been, Congress in enacting the law didn't put any parameters on what constitutes a national emergency. So it's broadly assumed that the president has a lot of discretion to determine what constitutes an emergency and in what situations. Here, however, there's questions about, very legitimate questions about whether the president crossed the line in both the way the emergency was created as an end run against exactly what Congress didn't want him to be doing, and also questions about whether there's even a plausible claim that there is, in fact, an emergency here.
President Trump said he is not the first president to declare a national emergency. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
There's rarely been a problem. They sign it. Nobody cares. I guess they weren't very exciting, but nobody cares. They sign it for far less important things in some cases, in many cases. We're talking about an invasion of our country with drugs, with human traffickers, with all types of criminals and gangs.
What are some of the other examples of presidents having used a national emergency to create action on an issue?
So there's a range of orders that have been used for sanctions, for export controls. There's been 50-some exercises of the National Emergency Act and the asserted national emergency power, and there's still some 30-some declarations that are still in effect. What's different here are two things. One, the claims of an invasion are not necessarily supported in any way by the actual facts. And in fact, President Trump's own statistics, administration statistics, show that the number of illegal crossings have gone down over time. And secondly, the specific use of the emergency in direct contradiction to Congress's clear wishes pursuant to the budget negotiations. And in fact, there's only been two actual exercises of the emergency power to move around appropriated funds in a manner different than what it was appropriated for. One was in the lead up to the Gulf War in 1990, and the other one was in the aftermath of the attacks in 2001, the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. This is obviously a very different situation where you have had congressional deliberation about precisely this issue. President Trump made a very impassioned plea to Congress to give him this money for the wall. Congress said no, and then the president goes ahead and says, well, I'm going to declare an emergency and get what I want anyway.
Jennifer Daskal is with us. She's an associate professor at the Washington College of Law at American University, and we are talking about President Trump's declaration of a national emergency to free up funds to continue building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. And Jennifer, one comment the president made during his news conference today has gained a lot of traction. Namely, he admits that he didn't need to make this emergency declaration, but he wanted to expedite the building of the wall. Let's take a listen to that.
I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster. And I don't have to do it for the election. I've already done a lot of wall for the election, 2020. And the only reason we're up here talking about this is because of the election, because they want to try and win an election, which it looks like they're not going to be able to do.
So, Jennifer, is that a surprising admission to make on the part of the president?
Yes, I mean, it certainly undercuts his claim that we're dealing with an emergency that justifies the use of the national emergency powers. And it certainly, as President Trump also stated, he expects that there will be litigation. There almost certainly will be litigation. And that claim certainly undermines his case, because one of the questions that is undoubtedly going to be raised is the president using the claim of an emergency as a pretext? And he seemed to be suggesting exactly that in his statement.
So when we talk about recourse for those who are opposing this move, what has to happen legally that could possibly, say, put this on hold, at least temporarily?
So Congress can override the president's declaration via joint resolution. The problem is what happens if the joint resolution then gets vetoed by the president. Congress could pass new legislation. Again, you have the veto problem. Congress, of course, can override the veto with two-thirds majority, but that's a hard thing to actually achieve. And then the other avenue is litigation, and the president himself acknowledged that there almost certainly would be litigation. Obviously, that can be a long, drawn-out process. A court could issue an injunction stopping the construction, stopping the moving of the funds.
Who would need to file in a court to get this in front of a panel of judges?
So there's a range of different possibilities. Some of the states affected could sue. There's a range of different people who would be in a position to challenge it. Members of Congress have suggested that they have. There's potential questions of what's known as standing, of whether they're the right people to bring the claim. But there's certainly states that can bring claims. There's individuals who could potentially be injured, because a lot of this land actually is not federal land. It's private land, so it's also going to require some takings of land to actually build the wall in the way that the president is suggesting.
I believe there's also Native American land involved.
That's correct.
So in the next few weeks, what are we likely to maybe see in the next few days as an immediate response? But then how do you see this kind of spinning out in the next few weeks?
So I think that there will, this does not come as a surprise. President Trump had forecasted for quite some time that he was planning to do this. So I expect that we will see litigation very quickly. We will see complaints filed. I expect that there will be a resolution in the House that will then go to the Senate. And in reality, the fact is that, the actual construction of the wall is not going to suddenly start taking place. There is a long, drawn-out process of actually moving the funds, like building up all the things, all the kind of things that need to happen before the construction actually happens. So it's not as if all of a sudden tomorrow there's going to be construction workers out on the border. Certainly the political process and the legal challenges will have some time to go forward before we see anything actually happening at the border.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for helping break down a really complicated issue.
Thank you.
Jennifer Daskal is an associate professor at the Washington College of Law at American University. She joined us to discuss President Trump's decision to use a national emergency declaration to increase funding for a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. And we want to know what you think. Do you support this move by the president? Do you think it was necessary, given that Congress did not approve anywhere near the amount of money that he was asking for a border wall? Do you think that we are currently in a national emergency on the U.S.-Mexico border? You can tweet us at WPR Central Time, WPR, and let us know. Losing a loved one is always difficult, especially after spending a decade or more together. And that's what's happened Wednesday out for NASA scientists and members of the general public who love to find out what goes on in the far reaches of space. On Wednesday, the Mars Opportunity rover was declared dead, almost 16 years after it first left Earth to explore fiery Mars. Some headlines about rover being pronounced dead showed how connected we felt to this piece of technology. The Express out of the UK asked, what were the final heartbreaking words boards of the Mars rover. The website Live Science wondered what will happen to the Opportunity rover's dead body on Mars. And rover scientist Abigail Freeman wrote an opinion piece for the Washington Post titled "Losing the Mars Rover Opportunity is Like Saying Goodbye to a Friend." And you might be wondering, what was that final message from Opportunity rover? It sent back to NASA, "My battery is low and it's getting dark." We'll go out on the last uplink NASA sent to Opportunity. Billie Holiday's "I'll Be Seeing You." This is Central Time.
Seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay, I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the